This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis, and today we're going up into the hills and back in time. Taking you to Laurel Canyon. It has always been kind of a dreamy place, lush with trees and tucked away houses. Up Laurel Canyon Boulevard, far from the towering billboards and strip malls of West Hollywood down below, you can imagine yourself back decades ago when a group of musicians in this small place changed folk music. All kinds of music, really, forever.
What I remember was a lot of people everywhere, all the time.
That's Moon Unit Zappa. Yeah, that Zappa. Her dad, Frank Zappa, who turned out to be a pretty famous musician, moved his family to the canyon back in the 1960s, not too far from the Canyon Country Store, which has been there for a century. That's why we're talking to her now, sitting outside at this picnic table. And she's recalling how her family lived a, say, different kind of life.
Apparently, my mother used to hitchhike with me on her hip, because my dad was actually a broke musician at the time. And so,
a starving artist
here, yeah, in the canyon. So she would hitchhike with me down here to the country store, barefoot, as one does. And apparently in the store, somebody approached my mother, who was a very attractive woman at the time, and I apparently said, as a two-year-old, "F off, pervert."
I asked Moon Unit Zappa for her specific memories of this place.
If they're nude, making candles near your toys, or if they start using your toys as instruments, or...
This happened to you as a child?
Does that sound specific to you?
Zappa wasn't the only musician tinkering away up in Laurel Canyon. Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys were there, experimenting with new kinds of sounds. California, and the canyon itself was the place to be.
All the leaves are brown, all the leaves are brown, and the sky is gray, and the sky is gray.
Musicians such as Mama Cass Elliott, John and Michelle Phillips from the Mamas and the Papas moved in nearby, as did David Crosby and Neil Young and Stephen Stills. And a guy named Graham Nash.
People would not even call. They'd just knock on the door and go, "Listen, hey, listen to this." That's an incredible environment for a musician to be in, because it's incredibly healthy and incredibly forward-looking and incredibly creative. And that's how I was feeling.
That's Nash speaking in the film Echo in the Canyon. It's a new documentary that celebrates the explosion of popular music coming out of here in the mid-1960s as folk went electric. Buffalo Springfield, The Association, The Byrds. The documentary hits theaters tomorrow, so today we're talking to the filmmakers Andrew Slater and Jacob Dylan at a Laurel Canyon institution, that country store right along the main drag. Slater says all that musical energy had been out east, but then...
Byrds had a hit song, and the music business shifted from New York to L.A., and people came here in search of that dream that they saw on A Hard Day's Night, being in a band, writing songs, and living that lifestyle.
So the music industry was in New York, and then all of a sudden it shifted to L.A., but what was it that made the music come out west?
Well, when you talk to some of the artists, like we talked to Stephen Stills, and he said, "Look, I was going to go to New York, because I was a folk singer, but I wanted to play folk songs on electric guitar, much like the Beatles." And I think in New York, the rigidity of the folk scene maybe never would have given birth to the electrification of folk music, but because California does represent so many things, I mean, it represents a sense of freedom, that anything is possible, and I think in that way, when Roger McGuinn picks up the Rickenbacker 12-string and electrifies folk music and has a hit with that, it's... you know, first time songs of poetic depth and grace become hit songs, and it inspires people to write differently, and it also inspires them to come to the place where that music's being made, which is here in Los Angeles.
Hey.
Jacob Dylan, could have been the Valley, it could have been Hollywood, it could have been, you know, Santa Clarita, it could have been downtown LA. Why Laurel Canyon? Why this stretch?
It's the wilderness up here. So it feels like Northern California, feels like anywhere, but you are less than 10 minutes from anywhere, which is probably why it wouldn't have been downtown or the Valley. Because if you go up the hills here, you've got coyote, you've got deer. And so, you know, it gave them more of a homey, woodsy vibe than typical Los Angeles, I suppose.
Slater says those notes are like a trademark of this place.
The first time you hear the opening notes to Turn, 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 or any of the vocals in Turn, 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 you're instantly brought back to this time of innocence and the beginnings of what we're describing as the California sound. I think the California musicians trying to grab hold of the sound of the Beatles, you know, it's like light goes through a prism and it comes out something else. And I think that was what was happening here with California.
One part of the doc that I was really sort of enamored was when it was Brian Wilson who said I was a big fan of Rubber Soul from the Beatles, right? And I wanted to sort of toot around with that and see what I could come up with. You know, then you hear Ringo Starr saying, well, you know, we were a big fan of Pet Sounds and what the Beach Boys did. And then all of a sudden it was like, so it's one band helping another band helping another band.
Roger sees A Hard Day's Night. He sees George Harrison playing the 12-string guitar. He electrifies folk music. He does a version of Bells of Rimini. George Harrison hears Bells of Rimini. He writes If I Needed Someone. That goes on Rubber Soul. Brian Wilson hears Rubber Soul. And he writes Pet Sounds, and the Beatles hear Pet Sounds, and they write Sgt. Pepper. And that really is the echo of people's creativity bouncing between each other and then across to England.
And it wasn't just the music and the ideas that were bouncing around. Here's Michelle Phillips from the Mamas and the Papas, who's interviewed in the film.
On the cover of our first album, I'm lying back in Denny's arms. This is before we got caught. Really, the first night that we were together, we had all been sitting at the table, and John and Cass, we looked over, and they were asleep. And that's when Denny just got up, and he walked over to the sliding glass door, and off we went. I was raised in a very free atmosphere. To me, having an affair was not as serious as it was to the rest of them. I had had an affair before Denny, when John and I had first gotten married. So it was something that John had already experienced with me. And that's when he wrote Go Where You Wanna Go. Go where you wanna go, do what you wanna do with whoever you wanna do it with, bitch. You gotta go.
And the film's director, Andrew Slater, says there were a lot of folks hooking up with a lot of folks.
Roger McGuinn tells a story that they were at a turning point in their career and they were looking to find a song to put out as their single in, I think, 1967. And they enlisted the help of Carole King and Jerry Goffin, who were writing girl band kind of songs, but they were moved to California and they were writing a hipper thing. And so they decided to do a song called Going Back. And as the story goes, David Crosby wanted to have his song as a single, and that was tried, and it was about a menage a trois. You want to know how it will be, me and her, for you and me. And in 1967, I'm not so sure AM radio would have played a song about a menage a trois, and that led to, you know, the another disagreement in the Byrds that was allegedly the final straw. Although David really zeroes in on that and defines it, you know, a little more graphically than I can here on the radio.
What about the Laurel Canyon sound today? Do we still have it, or is this just another part of L.A.?
The sound right now I hear is people buying groceries in the Canyon store, so that to me seems to be the defining sound of the moment, and the Canyon store is still here. But as far as a music scene that's centered here, I don't know if I could identify it.
Does that trouble you, do you think, or is it just times change?
No, I think it moves around. I think in Silver Lake and in Echo Park and in Eagle Rock and in Atwater, there's tremendous creativity and people of all kinds of art forms trading ideas. And, you know, L.A. is such an amazing city. You're always on the edge of wilderness, and I think your proximity to that gives a sense of openness and freedom, and it's created some of the great music of the last 50 years here.
What about you, Jacob? Do you see, I mean, you obviously keep tabs on the music industry. It's a different industry, different beast than it was decades ago, but not that long ago.
Could Laurel Canyon happen again, the music scene?
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose, but awfully expensive now. I don't know that bands are going to come in here and get an apartment or a house for $200 a month.
Starving artists, they couldn't
do it. I don't know if they could survive here, but it could do something else. It wouldn't be like that again. And that's like kind of suggesting you could go back up to Seattle and have another explosive grunge scene. It just, why would you? And the climate doesn't call for it.
So where's the next Laurel Canyon, do you think? Is it Nashville? Is it, you know, back in New York? Is it, where is it?
Everybody go to it, but let's not put it in Los Angeles. We're full. Too crowded.
Are you serious?
It's too crowded here. It was crowded everywhere. I don't know. If we knew, I'd go start selling t-shirts today. I'd go set my shop up.
Echo and the Canyon premieres tomorrow at Arclight Hollywood and at the Landmark in West L.A. Now everything is easy 'cause of you. Well, 50 years after the Laurel Canyon era, yeah, musicians are still creating new sounds here in Los Angeles. But who are they? Where do they live? Where do they work? And how will today's music scene be remembered? Christina Benson is the publisher of the independent music magazine LA Record, and she's with us right now. Hello, Christina.
Hey, Steve.
You know, we just heard the Laurel Canyon era and how musicians lived and practiced and collaborated in the same neighborhood. Does that happen in LA today?
It sure does. And also the other thing that happened, you know, the documentary talks about how artists left New York in order to come to Laurel Canyon. And that's something that we're seeing more and more in our LA Record interviews.
But rent isn't $200 a month, right? Or even $50 a month as it was way back in the day.
No, it certainly isn't. But what's interesting is that a lot of the times, I mean, we don't always ask why they move, but one of the things that happened, they happen to mention in passing a lot of the time, is that they move here because rent is cheap. So I guess it's all relative.
Compared to New York, rent is cheap.
But that said, rent is definitely a factor in where a lot of musicians are living and working. I mean, once musicians have maybe a label deal or maybe they have some sync licensing opportunities under their belts, they can still afford to live in a neighborhood like Echo Park or Silver Lake or Highland Park. But we're seeing more and more communities of musicians in places like Chinatown or like the South Bay, the suburbs. And sometimes we're seeing kind of musicians that are more fragmented, making music on their laptops in places like Montebello or Orange County or the Valley or even the desert.
So you're saying technology has sort of advanced us to a point where we don't have to live in the same neighborhood anymore. We can connect like through GChat or whatever.
Absolutely. And interestingly, I mean, there's musicians that talk to us that they live in the same house, but they still collaborate over the computer in different rooms, emailing files back and forth, and might not even work on a track together, you know, from start to finish.
All right, so the virtual community is happening and the collaboration is happening. Is LA, Christina, still a place, though, that's influencing music elsewhere the way it was, say, 50 years ago?
Oh, I mean, I would say absolutely. So many important, huge record labels are out here, huge in terms of their influence on not just American culture, but world culture, are in Los Angeles and in Orange County. I don't want to name them because I'm afraid of missing some, because there's just so many. There's so many scenes. Not only are there scenes emerging now, there are scenes that emerged 10, 15 years ago that are still here. We've got the jazz scene, hip-hop scene, punk scene. We have kind of this laptop, I don't even know what to call it, just sort of DIY electronica laptop music. We have glam scene. We have sort of a psych scene. We have so many different scenes that overlap and happen at the same time that were happening 10 years ago and are still happening now. So I would say absolutely LA music has not just an outsized influence on American music, but even world music in a lot of ways.
I don't know if I'm going to be here 50 years from now. maybe. I hope you are. Where will the next documentary about the LA music scene be made? I mean, what are we going to be talking about decades from now about the LA music scene?
I mean, there's so many interesting scenes that I hate to pick one, but I guess I'm going to.
You
got to
pick one, Christine. I'm putting you on the spot.
All right, I'm going to pick one. You're putting me on the spot. So there's an interesting scene kind of elaborating or coming out of Chinatown, and it kind of reminds me a lot in some ways of sort of the smell and the low-end theory scenes from 10 years ago. There's a lot of energy. There's a lot of cohesion. There's a lot of innovation. There's a lot of support. And I wouldn't be surprised if someone breaks from here to regional or even national success. And why is it coming from Chinatown? Possibly because that's where musicians can afford to live. The venues there are generally DIY and unlicensed, but artists can certainly catapult from there to playing bigger spaces. There's also some great jazz music coming out of LA. I mean, we all probably have heard of Kamasi Washington. There's still more jazz artists that we're still, I think, going to be hearing of. And I think LA later is going to be known as a place that really contributed to more innovations in jazz in the early 21st century.
I mean, do we have any specific, you mentioned Kamasi Washington, but like other artist styles that perhaps you can highlight?
Black Nile, Ryan Porter, of course, Flying Lotus. I know his kind of big album, Cosmogranna, came out a while ago, but that is still influencing people. Here's a track from Tolliver. He's an extremely talented artist who is living and working in that Chinatown scene I mentioned. He also contributes occasionally to LA Record. We're really excited to see what he's going to do.
Where do we see these bands? I mean, you mentioned Chinatown, you mentioned Echo Park and some other places. Where do we go to see these emerging LA musicians?
I mean, we have in LA, we have Stone's Throw, we have Danger Bird, we have scenes like The Smell, we have The Echo, we have the Grand Old Echo, we have people who still play in those venues, and then they bring new people in them to keep playing, you know? And I feel like in the mid-2000s, it feels like things were started. I remember especially something about the year 2010. I don't know why, but so many amazing albums came out that year, and those people who made those records are still here. They're often producing for new bands, and tons of new things have arisen. So LA has more venues and more labels than it ever has before, and there's more infrastructure here, but there's also more competition.
Christina Benson publishes LA Record. Christina, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to talk more about marijuana. A couple of years since cannabis became legal in California, where are all the pot shops and the tax money? That's next on Greater LA.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Recreational marijuana is legal in California thanks to passage of Proposition 64 a few years back. But the measure that legalizes cannabis use promised some local control, saying cities and counties could decide for themselves whether they would allow sales within their jurisdiction. So far, the result is that many cities have outlawed pot shops, even cities such as Burbank and Anaheim, where a majority of their residents voted for the measure. In fact, the number of licensed shops across the state is only at about 10% of what was expected to be in place by now, and that means tax revenues are also much lower than expected. So Assemblyman Phil Ting, he's a Democrat from San Francisco, wrote Assembly Bill 1356, and that would force these cities and counties to allow a certain number of cannabis businesses to open. Lauren Estevez is a local attorney who specializes in cannabis law and business, and she's with us right now. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Steve.
I want to start with the basics with you, because if this law passes, the one by Assemblyman Ting, what will it do?
Well, essentially, if this law passes, it would mandate cities and counties to have a minimum number of cannabis retail stores within their jurisdiction. Right now, there's 482 cities and 58 counties across California, and the vast majority of them ban cannabis retail shops within their boundaries. So this bill would create opportunity for additional cannabis stores, and it's estimated that it would create an additional 2,200 cannabis retail stores throughout the state. And it would do this by mandating the cities and counties to meet a minimum requirement of one cannabis retail establishment for every six liquor licenses within the city or county.
And just to be clear, this is only cities where voters in those districts, cities, counties, have passed the measure, passed Proposition 64. I mentioned Burbank and Anaheim, Downey. Are there more cities in Southern California that have blocked the sale of pot?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a better question is which cities have not blocked the sale of cannabis in Southern California. It's extremely limited. LA City is one example of a city that has legal cannabis retail. West Hollywood, Santa Monica will be issuing medical cannabis licenses, but really it's only a handful of cities in Southern California. The vast majority have banned cannabis retail shops.
Let's hear from Downey's mayor, Rick Rodriguez. He spoke to KCRW's Larry Perel.
You know, I view it as a gateway drug. I view it as forever. It's always been considered a gateway drug, an illegal drug. Now that it's legal in the state of California, doesn't make it any different than it was before as far as being a gateway drug. I think it's more harm than good.
Do you think then this bill, Assemblymember Ting's bill, would then usurp the power that the mayor of Downey has?
Well, this is the fundamental question with AB 1356. Should cities and counties be governing land use? Should they be governing permitted uses within their borders? Or is this more of a state issue? Or are there certain areas where the state's interest should supersede the city's or the county's interests, such as here with cannabis legalization, where it's legal on the state level, but the cities and counties have implemented so many bans that the tax revenue from Proposition 64 and the economic benefits have not been able to be fully realized.
And let's be honest, I mean, before the legalization of cannabis, people were buying and selling pot, right, illegally. So how does the black market factor into all of this?
Right. So proponents of the bill say that the bill would help undercut the black market, which has actually grown since legalization in 2018. It's estimated at present that 80% of the cannabis activity in California as it stands now is illegal. So there's many factors that led to this, but proponents of the bill argue that the city and county bans directly impact the black market and have caused it to grow.
Obviously, if Ting's bill passes, it's sure to be challenged in court since it is obviously changing the rules established in a statewide measure. What are the chances that it passes muster?
You know, this is a question that's actually being considered because a new regulation, which was implemented in January of this year, said that cannabis delivery companies that are licensed by the state of California can deliver anywhere within the state, regardless of the law in the local jurisdiction. So a group of 24 cities band together and are currently suing the Bureau of Cannabis Control. It's before a judge, so we, you know, ultimately we'll have to see how it ends up being decided. But I wouldn't be surprised if 1356 passes if it also results in litigation.
Lauren Estevez, a local attorney who specializes in cannabis law and business. Lauren, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
And that's Greater LA. Next up on KCRW, The Bookworm reads you a story. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ears today. Have a great day.